Welcome to Radio Shalom. I'm Deb Levy, and today we're going to be talking about Yom HaShoah. Yom HaShoah, in Hebrew, Yom is day, Ha is the, and Shoah is the word that we use for the Holocaust. And while it might sound like today's program is going to be a heavy one, my hope is that by the end, we'll all be able to walk away feeling uplifted, inspired, and confident enough to express and enjoy our own spiritual and religious identities. For those who aren't familiar with the Holocaust, we're talking about, or the Shoah, we're talking about an event which took place during the Second World War and resulted in the systematic murder of 6 million Jews. The Nazis, under their leader Adolf Hitler, wanted to wipe out the entire Jewish people and to erase Judaism. And this started with a series of laws that focused on banning religious, spiritual and cultural Jewish practices and escalated into mass murder. Just to add on a personal note, I feel very fortunate to be here today because I'm actually a third generation survivor of Nazi Europe. My grandparents, thank God, escaped and made their way ultimately to New Zealand. And that's why I'm here today and able to share this program with you today. As a community, we always mark Yom HaShoah together. And for the Auckland Jewish community, that means bringing together not just the two different synagogues that we have here in Auckland, but also members of the wider community. And this year, we were really privileged to have the Honourable Jenny Salesa, who joined us for our commemorations, and also the Honourable Alfred Naro, and also New Zealand Human Rights Commissioner Professor Paul Hunt as well, along with many members of the Diplomatic Corps and honorary consuls, rabbis and community leaders, and all ages that came and joined us. People are often interested that we talk about such a horrific and difficult part of Jewish history with the younger generation, but all of the children in the community grow up knowing about the Holocaust and understanding how important it is to be an upstander instead of a bystander. So to make sure that whenever we see injustice, bullying, intolerance or discrimination, that whatever our age or stage, wherever we are, we have an obligation to stand up and make sure that we speak out, because the consequences of not speaking out have been so, so devastating for our people and for so many others around the world as well. One of the things that I learnt as a student was just how important and relevant the Holocaust is for all of humanity. I think being Jewish, I grew up understanding it was important for my community, and also being a third generation survivor, I understood that it was a really important part of my own story and my own family. And I possibly underestimated the importance of the Holocaust in shaping the way that all of us think about discrimination. And a real aha moment for me, I remember talking to one of my friends at university, and he was telling me about a scholarship that he'd been on in Europe, where he'd been overseas playing tennis. And during his holidays, he'd decided to travel to visit some of the concentration camps in Europe. For those who are unfamiliar, the concentration camps were horrific slave camps where Jews and other persecuted groups were brought together, sometimes for the purpose of work, of slavery, but ultimately for the purpose of death, to kill as many people as possible. And naively, I said to my friend, "Oh, but you're not Jewish, so why did you want to go and visit a concentration camp?" And he looked at me with surprise and a little bit of horror and said to me, "But Deb, I'm not Jewish, but I'm a member of humanity. Every person needs to see these things. Every person needs to remember these things. And every person's responsible for making sure they don't happen again." And that was a humbling moment for me. It really was a moment in which I realized how narrow my view had been and how essential and important it is to widen the perspective of why Holocaust education is so important. Unfortunately, in New Zealand, in terms of our legislation around education and what's included in our curriculum, there's only a requirement for schools to teach up until the rise of Adolf Hitler. So they get a political picture of Europe and an understanding of World War One and the lead up to World War Two. But unfortunately, currently the curriculum stops at the rise of Hitler, so there's no requirement to learn about the Holocaust. And yet there are some amazing programs that are taking place in New Zealand today, and for any educators who are listening, it's worth getting in touch with the Holocaust Centre of New Zealand, headed by Chris Harris. They do amazing work with different programs that they run in schools, and different, not just focused on the Holocaust, but also focused on targeting bullying and encouraging young people to find their voices, not just if they're the victims of bullying, but actually if they're witnesses to it. How can they transform themselves from being passive witnesses to actually being those who stand up against the bullies and are there for those who are being bullied? So one of the things that I find incredibly inspiring when I look at the different stories and witness accounts that come out of the Holocaust is the fact that despite the risks that were associated with religious or spiritual cultural practices, there were so many brave adults and so many brave children who continued to practice their Jewish traditions in the most horrific of circumstances. And I think that when we consider the events that have been happening in our world recently, particularly close to home with Christchurch, and the attacks on worshippers who are just practicing their religion in their mosques, the attacks on worshippers in churches in Sri Lanka, and more recently the attack on the synagogue in California, which was 6 months to the day of the attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh. It seems that actually it's not something in our history that practicing one's religion is an act of bravery. It's not something we can say is just part of that Holocaust era. But actually today, practicing our religion, practicing our spiritual and cultural beliefs, for all of us can be a real act of bravery and defiance against evil. And what I would encourage all of our listeners to do is to think about one more thing that they can do in terms of their own cultural identity to make sure that they are celebrating their diversity and not being afraid of it, even though it can be a bit of a scary world to be different in at the moment. So when we reflect on the acts of bravery, one of the amazing things that comes to mind for me is that so many of them were done by children. And I want to start with a story from Rebbitson Amelia Jacobovitz. She's the Rebbitson, the wife of the former chief rabbi Jacobovitz in the UK. And she was born as a child into an impossible world whereby her family was on the run from the Nazis and didn't know what to do in terms of to protect her and to protect the rest of the family. And during the course of events, she ended up being separated from her family and was wandering from village to village in France. And she was so blessed to be found by a local farmer. He wasn't Jewish, but he had sympathy for the Jewish people and particularly for the plight of these lost children. And he took her, brought her to his home, and he had a little cellar which had only one tiny window, and he lowered her into the cellar, and there were ultimately three other children who he also saved in that way. And through that window every day he would bring them food, water, and would also send down a bucket so that they could do their ablutions and then send them back up to him. And this was how these four children survived the war, thanks to the incredible bravery of that righteous farmer who believed that he needed to do the little that he could, even though it was absolutely a risk to his life and the life of his family. And what was really interesting is that each of the four children took quite a while to confess to the other children they were hiding with that they were Jewish, because they'd been taught so, with such a strong message that being Jewish was really dangerous and they must conceal their Jewish identity in this climate of the Holocaust. And so even to each other, they very tentatively started kind of dropping hints about their Jewish identity until they felt they were able to each claim that they were Jewish and be able to share that with each other. The four children came from very, very different backgrounds. Amelia was the daughter of a rabbi and had grown up Orthodox, but the other children ranged from very secular and had only been kind of peripherally and culturally involved in Judaism to more traditional but not observing all of the strict laws, right through to Amelia, who'd grown up in the house of a rabbi. And one of the things that they connected with was the festival of Passover. So Pesach in Hebrew, or Passover, is the commemoration of the Exodus from Egypt. And it is the most celebrated and marked festival in the Jewish calendar. The Pew Institute did research about how many Jewish people celebrate Passover. And for example, in Israel, where, you know, they're a huge population that isn't religious at all, but even so, 97% of the Jews who live in Israel celebrate Passover and have a Passover Seder, which is the special meal with all the symbols and signs of the Exodus. And in America, where there's also a large Jewish population, 87% of all the Jewish people there are celebrating Passover. And we notice here in New Zealand that when we have Passover celebrations and commemorate the Exodus from Egypt, it's a time when far more members of the community are involved in those religious and cultural practices than during other times of the year. And these four children looked up to the little window that was kind of their only connection to the outside world. That was where the farmer passed and things, but that was also the only source of information. And they saw that there were some tiny strands of grass that were starting to grow along the edge of the window. And they realized that meant they must be approaching spring. Now, in the Northern Hemisphere, spring is associated with Passover. That's the time of year in which we celebrate Passover. And so the children talked amongst themselves and realized Passover must be coming soon. And they decided that even in the situation they were in, they were going to mark Passover. And so they asked the farmer if he could get them some flour, some water, some newspapers, and some matches. Because the big symbol of Passover and one of the mitzvot, one of the important good deeds that you do for Passover, is to eat matzah. Matzah, the unleavened bread, because when the Jews left Egypt, there was not time for the bread to rise. And there's a whole level of spiritual significance that comes with the matzah too, a reminder for us not to be puffed up and haughty and full of ourselves like bread, but more to be humble and flat and simple like the matzah. And so the children had to wait a while because it was very hard for the farmer to get hold of the things that they needed. There were shortages everywhere at that time during the war, but he managed to acquire what they wanted. And the children worked together to make the matzah as best they could, created a dough, then created a small fire and cooked their matzah. And then they went round together and tried to remember all the bits of the Passover Seder that they could to prepare themselves to be able to have this special Passover meal together. There's a beautiful tradition as well that you have new clothes for Passover. And the children were well aware that this was not a possibility. But there were two girls and two boys who were together in hiding on this farm. And so they decided that before the Passover dinner that they wanted to have, they would switch clothes. So the girls would switch clothes with each other and the boys would switch clothes with each other. And in that way, even though they couldn't have new clothes, they'd be wearing clothes that were new to them. And when the Rebbetzin talks about that Passover, and thank God she's had many Passovers since, including ones with her whole family together, ones in which her and her husband have been leading community. And yet she says the purity of the connection and the spirituality and the bravery and the camaraderie of that Passover Seder is something that she will never forget for the rest of her life and completely surpasses any other Passover experience she had before or since. It's a story she's really proud to share with her grandchildren and something that she holds on to as an inspiration for being able to find ways to connect with our own spirituality, with Hashem, with God, and with our own history and culture, even under circumstances where it's so difficult and it seems quite impossible. And so when I hear stories like this, and I think about how since some of the terrorist attacks that have been taking place here in New Zealand and around the world have happened, people are afraid to go to their places of worship. For me, this gives me inspiration to go, no matter how scary things are, no matter how difficult things are, there's always a way for our spirituality, our religion, our culture, whatever it may be, to push through the darkness. And I think that's really, really important. One of the things that we do each year to mark Yom HaShoah is we light 6 memorial candles. 6 because of the 6 million, so one for each of the million people who passed away. And yet when we look at these huge numbers, it's very hard to fathom. I mean, 6 million people, that's more than the total population of New Zealand. It's very hard to get one's head around tragedy when it's a big abstract number. And yet when you look at people's personal stories, I think that's when you understand a little bit more about just what we've lost. I'm blessed to be friends with Bob and Frida Narev. Bob and Frida were both young children during the Shoah, and Bob spent 3 years in Theresienstadt concentration camp in Czechoslovakia, and he managed to survive but had horrific experiences there. Whereas Frida, she was younger and she was hidden with a Catholic family who were willing to risk their safety in order to protect her. But she was completely separated from her family. And by the end of the war, most of her family had been killed. And thankfully, her older sister was able to find her. And together, they were able to come out to New Zealand. But what I love about Bob and Frida Narev, what I respect so much about them, is they have spent the rest of their lives looking to the future, thinking about how they can bring more goodness, more light into this world. They've dedicated their lives to family, to community, and also to making sure that they fight against discrimination. And they continue to visit schools and other organizations talking about the risks of discrimination and bullying, sharing their story, both of them, which I love because it's not just a story of tragedy in terms of the Holocaust, but it's really a story of hope and of love. They have celebrated their 60th wedding anniversary this year, which, again, when they talk, they speak with hope, with love, with real gratitude for everything that they have. And their message is really, really clear. It is that no matter who you are or where you are, you have the chance to make a significant difference just by speaking up when you see injustice. Another story I want to share with you today is from Rabbi Lau. And in the future, we're going to do a program on Rabbi Lau because he's a very inspiring rabbi and someone that I've learned a lot from. But I wanted to tell you the story of him and his brother Naftali when they were staying in a concentration camp. And again, Passover was coming and they were so, so determined to mark Passover. And they'd been separated out into 2 different blocks. Rabbi Lau at the time, he was called Lulik. That was the nickname that his brother called him by. And one of the ways in which he'd survived is that he had a mark identifying him on his clothes as a Polish child, not a Jewish child. And that meant that he was in slightly better conditions in a different barrack, whereas his brother Naftali was with the Jewish prisoners and their situation was much more dire. And Lulik and Naftali would communicate through the fence when they could. And one of the things that Naftali had decided was that with Passover coming up, he knew the prohibition against eating chametz, leavened bread, and various other things. And he was determined that while he couldn't keep strictly all the laws of Passover, he would find a way not to eat the leavened bread. And, you know, for any of us, to go without bread doesn't sound like such a difficult thing. But when your daily ration and the thing that's keeping you alive is a small piece of bread, to make that kind of commitment could be a life or death situation. Not only that, But the Nazis had banned all types of Jewish practice. And so if Naftali was discovered, that would also endanger his life because they may kill him in response to him trying to keep a Jewish practice. Nevertheless, he decided he desperately wanted to keep Passover to the extent that he could. And so he started collecting and hiding potatoes as an alternative source of food for the 8 days of Passover. But he had another challenge because he was a slave and was going out to work each day. And that meant that he couldn't keep the potatoes anywhere. And that was where his little brother Lulik came in. Lulik at this time would have been around the age of 7. And what he was asked to do by his brother Naftali was very dangerous, but he understood the importance of it and he wanted to help his brother. So when they would meet at the fence, Naftali would smuggle him a potato and he would take it and keep it and save it for him, with the understanding that when it was time for Passover, he would be able to smuggle the potatoes back, and then that way Naftali would be able to have something to eat. It was a really dangerous plan, and yet, together, the brothers were able to pull it off. And that year, Naftali was able to mark Passover not just with the prayers and the recollection of the story of the Exodus from Egypt, but actually by fulfilling the commandment not to eat chametz, not to eat the leavened bread and other products during the Passover. And when Rabbi Lau, then Lulik, came to write his biography, he remembers in great detail the impact that had on him, how inspiring it was to see the passion with which Naftali had, you know, decided to keep the laws of Passover, and how important it was to have religious and cultural and spiritual identity, especially in a place like a concentration camp where everyone was working together to try and take away that sense of identity. So there are a number of different programs we've already spoken about today, but before we finish today's program, I do want to talk about one more that is incredibly inspiring, and that is the March of the Living. Every year since 1988, thousands of young Jewish people have joined with Holocaust survivors on this program called March of the Living. And it's an annual education program where the participants actually follow in the footsteps of Holocaust victims and survivors. And they come from all around the world. And each year we send young people from New Zealand as well. Very often the young people who go are third or fourth generation survivors themselves. So they understand a little bit about the Holocaust. But sometimes the people who go have no personal connection and yet want to be a witness, want to be able to see what remains of the concentration camps, to hear the testimony of the survivors as they talk about their experiences. Because as Elie Wiesel explains, you know, the idea of being a witness, this is something that's contagious. When we hear a testimony from someone who survived the Holocaust, we too have an obligation then to pass on that story and make sure that these atrocities aren't forgotten in order that they will not be repeated. So with the March of the Living program, one of the places that young people go and visit is the very well-known concentration camp, Auschwitz. And I had the privilege of travelling to Auschwitz. I say privilege because even though it's a horrific place to go, I am very grateful that we still have these concentration camps to stand and serve as a memorial to the people who died, but also as a place of education so that these events aren't forgotten. And when I travelled there, one of the things that was really in my consciousness was that my great-grandmother had also travelled there. But the difference was, thank God, I got to leave at the end of my visit, whereas her visit ended in the gas chambers and the crematorium. And I hadn't been on the March of the Living program at that point, but I'd heard about it. And I think I finally understood why they have the name March of the Living when I was walking back out of Auschwitz. Because it's not just following the footsteps of the Holocaust survivors, which is so significant. It's creating your own new footsteps that they did not have the opportunity to create. And I remember that feeling of walking along the train tracks in the opposite direction from which my great-grandmother would have arrived, and realizing how grateful I was to live in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and have the religious and cultural freedoms that I have here, and just how devastated I was that for her, she never got to walk out of that place. And yet, hopeful that her soul, her spirit, there was a part of her that was aware that her great-granddaughter was able to do that, and that, thank God, the world had changed from the world that she knew when she was in that horrific place. When we memorialise, when we remember, one of the things that we do is that we reflect on our relationship with Hashem, with God, with a higher power. And one of the things I find inspiring and sometimes challenging as I talk to different Holocaust survivors is the way in which their relationships with God have changed throughout their journey. There's an amazing story of a group of rabbis who are in a concentration camp who decide to put God on trial. The story became famous because Elie Wiesel turned it into a play, but is actually based on something that he witnessed while he was in the concentration camps. And these rabbis decided to put God on trial because they felt that the crimes that they were seeing around them meant that he had let down his obligations to the Jewish people, and that he was actually guilty, and that they were going to see together whether they would find God guilty of crimes against his people. And what I find incredible when I hear this story is not that they decided to put God on trial. From what I know of Judaism, Jewish tradition, and Jewish people, we're no strangers with arguing with God. We have a lot of chutzpah, a lot of cheekiness, and it doesn't surprise me that a group of rabbis decided to put God on trial. But what did surprise me and what I found amazing is at the conclusion of the trial, they had found God guilty of abandoning the people. And yet, they looked up at the sky and realized that it was time for the afternoon prayers. And so they stopped what they were doing and returned and prayed to the God that they had just found guilty. Throughout all of our lives, we have moments in which we experience great light and moments in which we experience great darkness. And yet, even when one is angry with God, one is still in relationship with God. I really believe that for all of us, we need to just stay in conversation. And when we look at the kinds of atrocities that were committed in the Holocaust, I think all of us have questions. And yet, there's nothing that stops us from continuing to ask them. The opposite of love is not hatred. The opposite of love is really apathy, not caring at all. So when we look at some of the horrific things that have happened in history, and when we look at some of the horrific things that we see happening in our world today, the most important thing is that we care. It's all right to be angry, it's all right to be upset, but what we don't want to do is to become numb. And I really admire and appreciate those who continue to share their stories of the difficulties that they've gone through, because they help us to avoid that trap of becoming numb to things that are really important. So hopefully we can go forward inspired by people like Naftali, by people like Amelia, who managed to find ways to express their spiritual and cultural identities, even under the most terrible and difficult of circumstances, and that we can all continue to go forward and express who we are as well. Thank you for listening to Radio Shalom today. I'd like to shout out to Joan Lardner, who's been such an amazing part of Radio Shalom for so many years, and thank her for her ongoing inspiration. And I'd also like to thank our sponsor, NatureBee. If you'd like to hear this program again or want to hear more of Radio Shalom's programs, you can head to Planet FM. And if you want to have any particular topics covered on the program, send us an email and let us know. We'd love to hear from you.